I would like to share with you a quote from Ram Dass. When you go out into the woods, you look at trees. You see all these different trees. And some of them are bent, and some of them are straight, and some of them are evergreens, and some of them are whatever. And you look at the tree and you allow it. You see why it is the way it is. And you don't get all emotional about it. You just allow it. You appreciate the tree. The minute you get near humans, you lose all that. And you're constantly saying, you are to this, or I'm to that. That judgment mind comes in. And so I practice turning people into trees, which means appreciating them just the way they are. Please pause a moment and think about this reading. And then think about what qualities make you unique. Are you curvy? Are you straight? Are you somewhere in between? Is gender one of your unique qualities? When I was a student at the University of Houston, one of the best classes I took was on human sexuality. I learned a lot that class, but most of all, I remember that it opened my eyes that gender is not just binary, as boys and girls or men and women. Gender is a whole rainbow spectrum of unique qualities. Last Sunday, Matt kind of referred to this as false binaries. From as young as I can remember, I was called a tomboy. And I did prefer to do boy-like things. I would rather play kickball, ride my bike, or hike in the woods than play with dolls or make pretend tea parties. Why? It just came naturally to me. But it was the 1960s and 70s in Texas, and there were strong expectations as to what boys did and girls did. These expectations were enforced by my beloved elders, the church, and schools, especially schools. The dress code required that girls wear dresses to school. And girls did not play sports before Title IX. I remember being jealous of my brother who could play baseball and wear jeans. It did not seem fair. And as much as I tried to fit in as a girl, I felt like an outsider all the way through high school. So the human sexuality class in college opened up new possibilities to me as where I was on the gender rainbow spectrum. It was okay to sometimes feel like a girl and sometimes like a boy. I will always remember the class when I met my first transgender person. She shared her story about being born physically as a boy, but from the earliest of age, knowing that she was really a girl. Why? It was what came naturally to her. Then she simply asked all of us to think about, if we all have unique qualities in how we look, from the color of our eyes to color of our skin to how tall we are or short, and how we think, why can't gender be one of those unique qualities? So imagine with me that we all sort of understand that we all have qualities on the gender rainbow spectrum, and we don't get all emotional about it. We just allow it and even appreciate it. Imagine that we turn off that judgment mind when it tries to come forward, and we practice turning people into trees, which means appreciating all of us just the way we are. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Linda. I am going to take this off because I don't want to burn it in the candle. Excuse me. So I identify as a bisexual person, and I identify as a non-binary femme person, and I have other identities that I use in different venues that, you know, might be nice to speak about a little later. But my topic today that I was asked to speak about was trans law in Massachusetts. The last 2.5-3 months, I've been on Saturdays and Thursdays volunteering with Freedom for All Massachusetts, which is the insert flyer in your folder. It's an organization that has both C3 and C4 parts to it, which means that some of it is educational and some of it is electioneering and direct election advocacy. These last several months, starting in about November, Freedom for All Massachusetts has been working the education side of things and trying to build its volunteer base. There's a lot of misunderstanding out there about the law itself, that it even exists, and about transgender folks and gender non-binary and agender folks who are our friends and neighbors. So that's what I've been doing. It's going door to door. It's knocking on doors. It's using voter rolls. It's using, using the better angels of my nature to, in effect, not start fights, but to listen. And listen very closely to what people have to say when they're asked some very basic questions. And one of the most basic questions that you can ask in this venue is, do you support non-discrimination protections for transgender people? And, you know, that's the first part of the conversation. And what generally happens at that point is people go, I believe in fairness. Fairness. Oh, I like fairness. Yeah, fairness is great. And then we have these little Kindles that have opposition messaging on them. It's a video. It's about 1.5 minutes. And it's, to the best of my knowledge, an actual video that ran on an actual campaign elsewhere that brings out a couple of poorly represented court cases and threw them on the television screens. And then we show this to the individuals who we've met at the door. And at about 20 seconds, they start going, ugh. And then they go, ugh. And most of them, at that point, if they're at all listening, will backslide. Despite their better angels, despite their belief in fairness, there's something in them that messaging tweaks. And at that point, it's on me at their door to try to present them with some alternative ways to think about these questions. Because the thing is, the messaging has begun in Massachusetts. There have been some video releases into the media water here that some folks are starting to pick up. And how to characterize this? It's a patently unfair argument that has been used against all LGBTQIA people from the beginning of the formation of our movements. You know, Stonewall was in 68. Anita Bryant came around in the middle 70s, and she was the individual who figured out that when you stigmatize particularly gay men with child molestation fears in the general population, you can win campaigns against gay people at large. Now, there is no scientific evidence that people who are, you know, LGBTQIA are more likely to break the law in this particular way than anybody else in the population. It is a, it's not even a causation, not equals correlation thing. It is far more likely that folks who are queer are going to be victims of the violence. And so let me pose you some questions, because that's basically what I do when I go to door to door. You know, you don't get in people's faces. It's their house. It's their porch. It's their screen door, you know? So you just say, well, have you ever met a trans person? And, you know, it's a really valid question because, you know, statistically speaking, throughout the United States, perhaps not in the Northeast, but take the entire of the U.S., and asks anybody whether they've ever met somebody who's LGBTQIA. And the answer will come back between like 75, 80 more of the time that they have, that they know somebody. Not only that they met, but that they know. But when you start talking about folks who are trans or gender nonconforming or agender, the number falls off to a single digit. There are reasons for this. I would say chief among them is the oppression of these folks because they do not enjoy blanket legal protections in the way that most folks do who are out and about, who are cis, who are straight, and simply don't have to worry about stigmatization in the same ways. So the question that I have when I go door to door is, have you met a trans person? And when the answer comes back no, okay, my next question is, have your kids or grandkids met a trans person or a non-binary person? And frequently the answer comes back, yeah, yes. And, you know, it forms the basis for a conversation because, you know, all of a sudden it's not about their fears anymore. It's about the next generation. And make no mistake, most of these folks are on the voter rolls, are either on the younger side or the older side. I would say that, you know, from the age of about 28 to about 42 is kind of like not the folks I'm talking to. They're either youngish or they're oldish, right? And so there's a need to frame the conversation in a certain way so that they understand what is at stake for whom. And it really is, in many cases, the younger people. And in terms of the folks that I've worked with on the campaign, it's really striking. I mean, how much leadership is required to be provided by young people on the ground level. I mean, it's not just because walking door to door is somewhat arduous. I'm sure that most folks in this room could probably walk door to door for a couple of hours and not, you know, collapse of dehydration. You'd be fine. What's going on here is that there's a dropout in the middle of life for gender nonconforming and trans folks, where these folks are, in essence, not in a coming out place, perhaps, or something, but they're not being tapped in this campaign. And it's just the oddest thing, because from what I know about the transgender population, I mean, they are a sliver of a slice, you know, statistically speaking. You know, we have all of these colors, right? And we're talking about the rights of a few balloons here, right? A few balloons. And yet we're being called upon as citizens of the Commonwealth to vote on their ability not only to get a coffee at Dunkin's without being harassed, but to go into hospitals without being harassed, and yes, use the restroom that conforms to their gender identity. Why public accommodations? Public accommodations law would seem like a no-brainer because we have the Interstate Commerce Clause, right, which doesn't mention gender. We have the Freedom of Association Clause in the Constitution, which is very open-ended and seated within other rights as well. We have all these things, and I'm not a constitutional scholar, but the question I keep coming back to is, why is this being put as certain folks have the right to freedom of association above others? And the reason that they're getting away with this distinction, which flies I'm sorry, hand motions, flies in the face of fairness, which is something that Massachusetts folks truly believe in. They believe in fairness and a fair shake. Time and again, door to door, fairness is what comes back at me every time, right? Is because the messaging is focusing on the old chestnut, essentially, that Anita Bryant introduced 40 years ago, and that still works. And the reason it works is because of ignorance of a piece of our population who are still heavily stigmatized. So, I want you to think about that for a minute. Was there ever a time in your life, and this is another question I have to ask at the door, I'll fess up, I've been fed my speech this morning. Was there ever a time in your life when you were ostracized, mistreated, felt excluded simply because of a characteristic of who you are as a person? And then we let them think about that for a minute. You know, and to the folks that I was canvassing in Quincy yesterday, we were on the water. It was, oh my God, what a day it was. It was before the thunderstorms rolled in, and the water was clear, and we were on like the wetlands estuary kind of area, and there were red-winged blackbirds, and there were kayakers, and people were mostly home because they were tending their gardens on this beautiful day. And I, you know, found people with beautiful lettuce gardens and doing their roses. And I asked them this question, and they looked at me, and they said, no. No, I don't know what that feels like. So where do we go with a question like that? Okay, and they still believe in fairness. Fairness matters to the folks here. The next question. Oh, of course. One other thing. Thank you, Mia. The fairness question, obviously, is something that's hard to overcome if you don't honestly believe you haven't been given a fair shake. But the messaging that's out there has to do with stigmatization. It has to do with some very, very hard beliefs that are hard to overcome and that have proven messaging ability time and again. It's being applied more broadly here and even further.